Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to give the last talk in this program. This is just a brief outline. So first of all, I think you know that we are basing our understanding, the science that we are doing with the gravitational wave experiment relies on the theoretical predictions on the waveforms. So I'm trying, I will focus on this talk on trying to address some of the questions here. Are we missing gravitational wave signals considering the searches we are doing, the templates we are doing? Are current inference studies in any way affected by modeling error? And this is for now, but what about the next few years? In fact, I decided I'm going to focus the talk just on advanced LIGO, advanced Virgo, and CAGRA. You know, I mean, it will be too much to include LISA or 3G detectors. I have some slides if you want at the end, but it will be. There is already a lot of material here, and so even with advanced LIGO and advanced Virgo, we want to extract. We want to maybe have some new sources detected, and for that, I mean. Maybe with effect like precession, eccentricity, etc. So do we need more science, more physics in the waveform? I think so. And what are the highest priorities? Now, in the first part, I will just explain for people here, thought maybe there could be people who are not expert in what we are doing. So I have some slides about that. But then I will also, because I care about going, especially in the second part of the talk, I will take some executive decisions about moving forward. Okay, so first of all, the waveform encode information about many physical effects. They are really fingerprints of the sources, the binaries made of black hole, neutron star that we are detecting. And these effects go from spins, other more sophisticated GR nonlinear effects, the fact that the black holes can be heated by absorbing the gravitational waves that are emitted. And so this is called black hole absorption. Then maybe for an audience which is a bit different from the one that we have here, we're also interested in strong field effects. Do spectroscopy with quasi-normal modes in the merger, perhaps seeing some signature of the absence of the horizon. And of course, then when you add matter or you modify your theory of gravity, you have also variation in the waveform with respect to the GR1, which is here represented in black. So maybe you want to see also this deviation. And certainly, we are interested in matter effects because we know that the neutron star exists. We have even detected them. Okay, so how this work of developing waveform model is done? So it's many years of work. It actually relies very much on a synergy between analytical and numerical relativity. We try to use the best of these two approaches. The Einstein equations are nonlinear, so it's very difficult just to actually, it's at the moment impossible to just take numerical relativity, solve the equation on a computer, and span the overall parameter space. Here you have the mass ratio, the separation between the two objects in units of GR over C squared. Because of the viral theorem, as you go to weak field, you also go to low velocities. So we have different approaches in which you solve the Einstein equation in an analytical way, but approximate it. And this is paper and pencil, it's fast, but it's approximated. Or you can use numerical relativity in some part of the parameter space. This is exact, except you have, of course, numerical errors. But it's slow because it takes time to produce these simulations. And so what are the main ways in which we have put this together? So I would say, let me say there are mainly three approaches. So one goes under the name of effective one-body approach, where, but actually even what is known to be the Inspire-Merger Rindown also use the same philosophy. So you produce numerical simulation in some point of the parameter space, symmetric mass ratio, binary effective spin. You see them in this plot here. And then you have a model which, for example, here in time domain, has the spiral and also an approximate way of describing the merger in DAO. But then you tune the model in some point of the parameter space where you have the numerical simulation, you improve your model until it agrees very well with numerical relativity. That's why the model now gets an NR because it uses information from NR. And then you also validate the model in point of the parameter space here indicated in red, where you have not used this waveform to tune the model, but you want a posteriori to check that the model works well. And you repeat this many times. So over time, people in numerical relativity have produced more and more simulation, and every time you have a new simulation, you compare the model, you see whether the model needs to be improved even more. Now, this is done in time domain with effective one-body approach. You can do actually a very effective way of producing a waveform that can be also very fast because they are closed form in the frequency domain. Is the spiral merger in DAO phenomenological models, goes under the name of IMR phenom. And this is done by first in time domain putting together an NR waveform and the UOB waveform, not calibrated, and then going the Fourier domain and doing the fit in the Fourier domain. That's why you get a closed form expression, which is very easy then to use also for inference studies. I want here to emphasize that it is important actually to use this effective one-body waveform instead of just pure post-Newtonian, because otherwise you will actually have a gap of accuracy because you cannot just join together the post-Newtonian and numerical relativity. There will be some inaccuracy in doing that. Now, the third approach, which has been also developed in the last few years, is actually to have what we call NR surrogate models. So this, what is done is that initially you basically try to understand using analytical models which are the waveform in the parameter space that have more impact in changing, you know, your waveform. In which point of the parameter space you need waveform that will have an impact more when at more signature in the waveform. And you do that by using an analytical model because you cannot produce many simulations. So you select the points in this way. But then once you have the waveform, the numerical relativity simulations in this point of the parameter space, you do an interpolation, directly interpolating the numerical relativity waveform, and you build these NR surrogate models. And these, of course, are more accurate in the region in which they are built with respect to the analytical models, but they have also some disadvantage because they are limited in that region of the parameter space where you build them in length and also in spins or mass ratio. And I will show you also later other results about this. Okay, now this is for binary black holes. So for binary neutron stars, we have repeated this work at the interface between analytic and numerical relativity. And today we have developed a waveform model which contain information from numerical relativity in the sense that they contain information of tidal deformability from analytical models, but then they are compared to numerical simulation. For example, this is a numerical simulation from Tim Tiedrich of two binary neutron stars. And here you see the snapshot actually here when the two objects touch each other, and then here is the merger part. And then you compare with models that have tidal effects more or less up to the point in which the two objects form one object. And then after that, actually, the merger is not captured by these analytical models, just up to when you have the two objects forming a single object here. Okay. So now another thing I wanted to say here more for the people who don't come. You have a question? Yes?
Are you going to talk about how accurate these matches are?
Yes. I will also talk about the systematics that people have seen in this, but this will be a bit later. Okay? And I will do the same for the binary black holes.
So sorry, are you going to
yes.
talk at all about the surrogate models, which I guess Vijay Varma and Leo Stein, they claim they're an order of magnitude more accurate than the things you've been describing? And
yes, I will actually have a plot about this later, but what I was saying before is that these models are actually only usable in the region in which they have been built.
Right, they're trained. Yeah, they've been trained over 30 orbits now. But, yeah.
Yes, but you know, this is 20 orbits, which is 40 gravitational wave cycles, not necessarily cover the bandwidth of the detector. It depends on the total mass of the system. So these are very good to do. In fact, there were even analyses against some of the events a posteriori, after a few years, to look at how biased the parameter can be. So I will say something about that. That's another tool. In fact, I just said that in the previous slide. Okay, but I want also to say something a little bit more basic, just to show you a typical template that we have. So if you start from the quadrupole formula and you compute the gravitational signal, at leading order there is some dependence on the distance, the velocity, then the cosine of 2 phi, which is the orbital phase, and the velocity for a circular orbit is also related to a frequency through this very simple relation from the Kepler law. And how do we build phase, okay, evolution? If you have from the dynamics, you can build the energy, the center of mass energy, which at leading order is just from the Newtonian gravity, is just proportional to v squared, and this is the reduced mass. And then from Einstein theory, because we have emission of gravitational waves, you have a flux, and this is the formula derived by Einstein, although with a factor 2 wrong, but this is the luminosity that depends on the symmetric mass ratio here, the reduced mass divided by the total mass, a certain power in V over C to the power 10. So you have the energy and the luminosity, and then you put them together, you say, okay, there should be a balance equation that says the loss of energy is equal to the flux minus the flux at infinity. And because the energy and the flux can be expressed in terms of the frequency, you can just rewrite this equation as d over d omega over dt, and you get an equation for the derivative of the frequency given in terms of the flux and the energy. So if you have a model for the flux and the energy, for the inspiral part of the signal, you are done, because you can just integrate this equation twice, and you get the phase. And you plug this in this equation here, and you have the evolution of the frequency, which is the phase, which is the most important thing that we care about, to match very well the phase. Okay? And the phase contains all this information that I told about before, spin, eccentricity, etc. Now, this is true in the inspiral part of the evolution, because generally the energy, you know, for the two-body system, you can describe it up to the point in which the two-body plunge, and the flux is the same. But then in this inspiral merger Rindal models, like the FAT1 body or the IMR phenomenon, you have a way of describing also the merger, the plunge, and the merger Rindal, okay? Same analytically, even just not using numerical relativity.
So, if you don't mind, phase, I understand the importance of it, but when we look at some of the precession waveforms, we see quite a clear modulation of the amplitude as well.
Yeah.
But even in that case, is the primary information about precession in the phase?
The information on the phase is very important still, but the amplitude is also crucial. And that's not a problem here. I was emphasizing the phase because, just to make the point that actually it's the most in general, you know, if you don't consider necessarily the precessing case. But the amplitude here is also, you don't just look at, you just use the leading order in this expression. I don't know what happened. Sorry, my talk disappeared. Okay, but you actually include all the amplitude correction. This is known in post-Newtonian theory. You can do resummation of them. It's just not the focus here, but you can actually do this. I mean, you can just plug them here. They will depend on the frequency, and so the frequency you get from this equation, and again, you can, you know, plug it there and then continue. Okay. Okay, so at the end of the day, so just one equation, I think the only equation in the talk, you end up, if you are in the frequency domain, besides a phase and a reference phase and reference time, you have an expansion in your V. This is the so-called post-Newtonian template for the phase, and you have the zero PL term, if you have dipole radiation because of a scalar tensor theory, just because we have charges for the two bodies carry charge, you have a term here, a minus 1 PM. If you have, for example, propagation effect different from GR because you have a mass for the graviton, so a Compton wavelength, you have a new term here. And then there are genuine effect from GR, 1 PM, 1.5 spin orbit, 2 PM effect, spin-spin enter at 2 PM. And then you have the tides that enter at genuinely, this is a 5 PM term, a V to the 10, with a coefficient in front that depends on the tidal deformability parameter, the equation of state, etc. And I want to emphasize that for neutron star black hole, this term is actually a little bit suppressed by the mass ratio of the system. We will come back to this later when I will discuss some neutron star black hole waveform modeling. But although this is suppressed, merger can happen at lower frequency for a neutron star black hole with respect to a black hole. And so tidal effects could be also, if we are lucky, extracted for a neutron star black hole system, even if you have a suppression of this effect because of the mass ratio. Okay? Okay, so now these waveforms are used in the template bank. However, let me also tell you which philosophy we have followed also within LIGO, and I believe also for people outside it. So because the waveform, I told you, are built by putting together analytic and numerical relativity, testing again numerical relativity in the region in which we can do that, after detection, we also want to make sure that we are not actually perhaps missing something in our waveform model. So we run simulations, at least we have done it, especially during the first observing run. This was a simulation done after the second event was found. It was a very long simulation. And it was used, for example, in one of the papers, to test, since the parameters of the simulation were coming from the, so first one did an analysis, a Marco Che Monte Carlo analysis, Bayesian analysis, with the templates, and 90% credible region were found for the waveform that you can see here in gray, not very well. And then within this 90%, the parameters were chosen to do the simulation. And then what you see here is the result of comparing the simulation at that point with the 90% credible region obtained against the data using the models. And you can see that the simulation fits the data quite well in this case. Then this was not just the only analysis that was done. I will come back to this in a few slides later. But the conclusion that was also in one of the LIGO papers, the first conclusion at the time was that systematics due to modeling are smaller than the statistical error for the gravitational wave event observed for 01 or 02. Actually, this will continue, as I will show you in a moment, I mean later, okay? There are tests that have been done also by people here in the audience. Okay, so how do we conclude also this? So one way is that you run your analysis using, for example, these two different models that I told you about, the UBNR and the IMR phenom. And these are two examples of the posterior distribution that you obtain for the masses, for this event, and also here for the masses. And what you can see is that there is no much difference between using the two models. And certainly, the difference are smaller than, you know, the statistical error that is set by the signal-to-noise ratio. These are just the 90% credible, you know, intervals that you see here in this plot here. And this is actually also true for the spins. So when you look at the posterior distribution for chi-effective, a certain combination of the spin of the two objects perpendicular to the direction of the orbital plane, and this is on the orbital plane, again, there are no large differences between the two models, which include, actually in this case, this was including precessional effect, this is without actually even precessional effect. So for this reason, in, for example, the catalog paper, when we reported result for the mass ratio or chi-effective, what we do is that we report result by combining the posterior distributions of these two models. And the reason is they are not, we see that they are not very different, but there are small variations, and so we use basically the combination of the two. Okay? And as you know, these are for the mass ratio, this is chi effective. Okay. So so then when we this is just to say that I believe, and people here from LIGO can also disagree with me, but I think the results, if we look more in detail at the results in the catalog paper, for example, the masses M1, M2 for the different events, this is the neutron star, the heavy and most distant binary black hole, 1702-29. You know, this is the most asymmetric object. This, the lines here represent actually the mass ratio lines at Q equal to 1 over 2, 1 over 4, and 1 over 8. Then, for example, you know, we have the lightest. The total mass was around 12, I think, the total mass of the system. This was actually around 80. So for the spin, the fact that we concluded, for example, in one case, the spin is larger than 0.299% confidence, or here we can exclude zero effective spin at 90%. I think this result holds based on the waveform model that we have and the consistency of the results that we have. This is just for the parameter that describe the projection of the spin on the orbital plane. So I would say is that conclusion, like for all the events that we are seeing, the spins are moderate and there is no evidence for spin precession. I would say these are quite robust results of our analysis. In fact, in some cases there is more effect due to prior choice for the spins than differences induced by waveform models, I think. Okay. So, any question about this part? We are all convinced until now.
Can I ask you what the difference is on the left and right, the color and the white?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Thank you. Especially for people here not. So, what you see here, of course, are the posterior distributions flipped so that you have these violin plots. And what you see here is the posterior distribution obtained by combining these models, and here is basically the prior. And so what you see from these plots is actually what we obtain for the posterior distribution is not very different from the prior for this parameter that measure the spins on the orbital plane, and that's the reason why at the end we conclude that we don't have evidence of spin precession. While here, as you can see, actually, from this parameter which measures the spin perpendicular to the orbital plane, you don't see here the prior, but actually here we can measure this parameter.
Alexander, just to clarify one thing, the white is actually the prior for the precessing spin, conditioned on the observed value of the effective spin.
Okay.
Right. So, for example, if you measured a very high effective spin, there's no spin left to put on the precession, because otherwise you have black holes which have greater than spin of one. Mm-hmm. So that's why the priors will have different shape. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the very last one, where you've measured the somewhat positive chi effective, mm-hmm. that's why the chi p prior looks a bit different than some of the others.
Okay, so now the other thing I wanted to say before more than discussing more physics in this waveform is that, again, to test the fact that we are using GR waveforms to do, that's an assumption of our all the analysis, use GR waveform. It's, again, another stringent test that we can do is to bound the parameters that enter in the phase that are the GR parameters and not something else. So I showed you before this slide with all the PN terms and all possible deviation from GR if you are in a scalar tensor theory or modified gravity theory, like with massive gravity. So the phase here has GR terms, which are indicated in red, but you can add possible deviation. And when you do the Markov-Chain Monte Carlo analysis, you can add, besides the 15 or 11 parameter, depending on the waveform model we use, you can add one of these parameters at a time, at a certain PN order and look whether this is the deviation from GR means it should be around zero, there should be zero, this parameter. So we have not seen deviations, but we can bound this parameter. So this plot shows this parameter, the upper bound on these parameters as a function of the post-Newtonian order. And there are many plots, many dots here. Let's focus on, for example, minus 1 PN. You see the different, actually the events that could be used because they could give bounds that were not incredibly, you know, uninformative. And in particular, we are dominated by the two events that are the longest, which is the gravitational wave 15-12-26 and the 17-06-08. And then we also combine them, either using the IMR model on the SUBNR. And you see again that if you look at how the difference between the two models are, is not, again, very different, even for this test here. Okay? And this has been repeated also for the binary neutron star. Yes.
On the PM parameter plot, are they allowed? Are all the delta phi ions allowed to float independently in one run, or are they varied one by one? So you basically say, let's pretend I could have a dipole term, but I'm going to keep everything else PM. Let's pretend I could have, or is it? Oh, I just put in a delta phi minus 1, minus 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
So in this test here, the catalog paper, we actually vary one parameter at a time. It's only in the first test of GR paper, gravitational wave 150914, that there is an analysis not just varying one at a time, but also varying them all together. And now the problem there is that, you know, you have many parameters, and the correct way of doing it would be to do afterwards a single value decomposition where you can actually look at which of these parameters really, combination of them really vary, because otherwise it becomes very uninformative. But this is varied one at a time, which you would say, maybe the reason why you ask this question is because when you have a variation due to, you know, non-GR, different gravity theory, it's not just one of these parameters that would be affected, but there is a leading term, because also there is a hierarchy because of the post-Newtonian. And so people have shown that, you know, in the regime where we are doing this, it's okay. I mean, if you add higher order correction, it's not going to change much the bound. Okay? Okay, so I wanted just to say that actually this has been, so this has been done also for the binary neutron star, where again, these two waveform models have been employed. Of course, you get a much better bound for the minus 1 PN here because it's more at low frequency. This was an event of 3,000 gravitational wave cycles in band. And here you see the violin plots again, that they agree also again quite well between the two models. Now, this is very reassuring, but I also want to emphasize, except for some of these post-Newtonian orders, you know, you have large variations here. I mean, large upper bounds in the sense, you know, more than 30, 40%, 100%. So this means that we are putting this bound for the first time, but this means also we have still a lot of freedom of, you know, to go outside GR, okay? I mean, there could be models which are not GR that might fit, especially for the higher order post-Newtonian parameters, which are not very well bounded. Okay? Okay, so now let me discuss, the first thing I wanted to discuss is eccentricity. So as we have also seen in this program, of course, people here working in information scenario are very interested to be able to discriminate between scenarios, and of course, eccentricity and spin precession are two important tools to do that. So how we are doing about modeling eccentricity? So there have been simulations done with eccentricity, and I'm showing you two snapshots here from a paper by Luis et al. From the SXS collaboration. Also, simulations have been produced using the Einstein toolkit, and here there are papers from Hinder, from Huerta, etc. There is not at the moment, as I wrote here, a model a waveform model with eccentricity, which has spins and eccentricity, which has eccentricity and also merger and ring down. There are pieces of work, some of them have in spiral, you know, part with eccentricity, even fast in frequency domain, but maybe they are covering only up to a certain value with eccentricity. So what is missing in this modeling of eccentricity is a model which really is in spiral, merge, ring down, eccentric, with eccentricity up to one, and even spins. But people are working on that. So this is, for example, a new waveform model built by Tanya Hinderen and Stas Babak a year and a half ago, but there is no spin here, and has also the merger ring down, but it's in time domain. As some of you know, time domain is not the fastest waveform model, so you would need even to build a surrogate or, you know, reduce order modeling of that. But still, let me tell you another example of these models combining analytic and numerical relativity. This is taken from a paper of Huerta of 2 years ago, and also there is work by Ian Kinder about that. So the waveform model that they built, which is actually non-spinning, let me emphasize, has the merger ring down, but is built in the following way. So there is first an assumption, which seems to actually be quite good up to certain values of the eccentricity, that if you start with a waveform with eccentricity x, you go toward the merger ring down, especially plunge and merger, the waveform become less and less eccentric, and the mergering down, it's a very good representation of the mergering down, is the one of a quasi-circular orbit. So what they do is that they built a model that in the spiral part has eccentricity, but then they join it to an analytical model for the mergering down, which is basically for quasi-circular orbits. Okay, so they join them together, and so you have a first example of a model which maybe for the mergering down for high eccentricity might not be very accurate, but has all the features of eccentricity for the spiral part, which is also important because that is the part that will last also longer in bandwidth. Okay? Yes?
So a question about that. I certainly, in when the two objects are very distant from each other, eccentricity is reduced by gravitational radiation. I've heard mixed things about what happens as you approach closer, about whether there can be a sustained eccentricity or even an increase towards the very end. What's the current status on that?
Okay, so if you are asking about some papers and some recent papers, maybe a year ago, by Nico Younes, yeah, that's not. Honestly, I don't think that that claim is there, that at the very end, during the plunge, you have this enhancement of the eccentricity. But anyway, even if you look at that, even if you were assuming that that is correct, it's not a very big effect. I mean, I'm more worried about really, you know, being able to track this effect of the eccentricity during the spirals than this tiny enhancement of the eccentricity at the very end. Yeah.
Just so does this matching work because the eccentricity is low at the merger, or is it just that it's effectively irrelevant?
Well, first of all, you make this assumption, and this assumption is valid only up to a certain value of the eccentricity. I don't remember, people have checked maybe 0.1 or 0.5, something like that.
Yes.
Because they did numerical simulations, and they have seen this, you know, from the numerical simulations.
Yeah.
Sorry?
But that's, I just don't, from where it enters band to where it merges, does the eccentricity change a lot?
The eccentricity can change quite, it depends, of course, on the mass and how many cycles you can have. But it can change, yes. But if you have an eccentricity of 0.8, 0.9, and you have this burst,
yeah,
that's not the model,
yeah, okay?
This is not the model that you would be using.
These are basically only valid in the regime where the eccentricity is small enough when you enter band, that by the time you get the bit where you're missing the plunge of merger, it's quasi certain.
That's what's happening. Yeah. It's low at the beginning, and then it's essentially relevant at merger.
Yeah.
And that's most things. It's really, really hard to get something so close astrophysically that you still have significant eccentricity by the LSO. And actually, I have a question based on that. If you still have significant eccentricity at merger, that actually significantly reduces the output of gravitational waves, right? Like, there's those plots from that, those old numerical relativity simulations where, like, if you still have that much...
Because it's basically radial?
Yeah, exactly. You basically no longer have
yes,
a time-dependent quantum
mode.
So at that point, I don't even think you get much of a signal because there's just no power.
Okay, so since I have the okay here of the person, so I wanted just to share with you. There is this paper that is coming out today on the archive. It's just the first analysis that was done by LIGO for eccentric binary black holes, not using templates, however. So this uses a minimal assumption search, is the coherent wave burst pipeline. This is just an example of a waveform model. They use actually a model for, let me go back. So this is a pipeline that doesn't use waveform, that use actually the coherence of excess power between the two detectors. But they also introduce another information. They actually do, in their analysis, they also take into account signals in which the frequency is increasing as a function of time. So there is actually some mild modeling, okay? What they did, this is actually from the paper, is the search range in megaparsec as a function of the chirp mass, and they determined by doing injections of signals with eccentricity, notice that this was a zero spin, they take signals that were modeled in this paper by William East, which is similar to the in some way, it's similar to the model that I was just explaining to you before. It builds on, for the dynamics, a Kerr, use kind of Kerr spacetime with correction that depend on the mass ratio, because you are not looking at extreme mass ratio binaries here. And then as a model for the merger ring down, built a phenomenological model by Nick Williams. So they use this, they do injection study to understand that we just were discussing, in fact, yesterday, the talk by Ian, to determine actually the range. And what you see in this plot, this was done for O1 and O2, is the result by varying the eccentricity from 0 to 0.9. So these are the different lines that you see here, depending on the mass ratio and the chirp mass. And now what you see here is actually what is the search range if you were using the CBC during O1 and O2. Of course, you are subdominant with respect to a model search because you are not using templates. But still, I think it's interesting to have used to have done the analysis with an unmodeled search. And then what they did, they considered a black hole population with these masses. They considered that the masses were distributed in M1 with this M1 to the minus beta power and uniform in M2. So they established the VT, the volume multiplied by the time that you see here in gigaparsec cube per year for different values of beta. And because they didn't have a detection, they could put an upper limit at 90%, and this is the result. Now, there is also, in the paper, they say that for beta equal to 1 and 2, 30 and 90 gigaparsec per gigaparsec cube per year, it's interesting astrophysically to rule out some of the, I think, two papers. These were, I think, the single encounter scenario with a supermassive supermassive black hole. I think you discussed this yesterday or the day before.
Single captures in
the where actually they gave a rate which was 100 they could reach 100 per gigaparsec cube per year. But maybe these values are still too large for constraining, you know, other possible scenario. But this is just to say something is happening and of course things can be improved with model, if we have models, and we can actually do the search, the model search with them.
So the eccentricities that you're considering, is that any eccentric thing, or eccentricity at 10 hertz at like 0.5?
I think this is the eccentricity at a certain value of the frequency. Now I don't remember the value.
Okay.
Maybe if people have looked at this, but it's a certain value of the, I think maybe at the beginning of the bandwidth. Okay? Okay, so so let me move on now to the precession and higher modes. Okay, we had in the previous slide that we have not been able to put to say anything about precession, and this is mainly due to the fact that the signals we are seeing are first of all mainly phase on, phase off, because that's also where the signal to noise ratio is largest. So at the moment we are biased because we are looking at the loudest events, and also they are not very long. Okay, but for example, this was just an animation done by Sergei Osokin. If you have a system, total mass 29, mass ratio 5, starting from 10 Hz, so this is more if you think about advanced LIGO design sensitivity, you will have almost 600 gravitational wave cycles. And with parameters, with spins that start almost on the orbital plane, actually here what counts more is the spin of the more massive body, because the smallest one doesn't have a very big effect. You have overall now 5 precessional cycles. The overall duration of this is 40 seconds. And this should move, but I don't see that it moves. I don't know why. Ah, yes, I didn't push. So this is actually the evolution of the orbital plane, which is going to have these 5 precessional cycles until the end. And now you see the difference between a precessing waveform and non-precessing. These are the modulation in the amplitude that Cole was mentioning before, which are important. But actually, it's also very important to track this precessional effect in the phase, which is not shown, in this plot here. Now, if you had this source, which actually at design sensitivity will have, for this particular case, an SNR of 25, at the distance was chosen in such a way that you had an SNR of 25. This would be actually the inference on the spin of the primary. This plot shows you the spin. This is actually telling you the magnitude of the spin if you go in the direction, and the tilt angle, the angle with respect to the direction perpendicular to the orbital plane. So this is the secondary, and this is the primary. So you can see that in this case, you can actually extract very well the spin, while the secondary is not very well determined. And if you want to compare with, for example, what we had 150914, you can see just by eye the huge difference between the recovery. So we might have these sources in advanced LIGO. The signal-to-noise ratio is not huge here.
What are the masses for the system, etc.?
The masses are, the total mass is around 30, and the mass ratio is 5.
Okay, so it's got more cycles than 15914.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's 10 Hz, actually, starting from 10 Hz.
What's the viewing angle?
This I don't remember. But, I don't remember, but it is changing quite a lot, the orbital plane. So I don't think it's what's chosen to be, optimizing, necessarily optimizing. It could be pi over 3. Not Hedron, not Hedron, not Fison.
But it'll vary no matter what.
What's the viewing angle relative to the total angle of momentum? Yeah. That's roughly constant, right? And if you saw this thing face on, even with all that perception, so if the total orbital angle of momentum is pointing towards you, you wouldn't see any perception.
the Richard and Andy wrote a nice paper on this a few years back that I think Steve has done some work on since, that basically said where it is relative beyond the detector and the viewing angle will determine how much of this you'll see. It's important to look at that as well.
It's a reasonable
Okay. Now, with precession, it's also important to include the higher harmonics. The fact that, because, okay, so this I didn't say. So the waveform models that we use, that we have been using until now, are only describing the quadrupolar emission, the 2-2, when you do the harmonic decomposition, the 2-2 mode, L equal 2, M equal 2, except in one of the precessive models, you also have the 2-1, but you know, otherwise it's really only the, but in the current analysis with O3, we are also starting to use some models with higher harmonic and spins aligned, and I want to now describe what has been done and what actually is even coming up. Okay, so as I said, there is the dominant harmonic, we want to reach the symphony. So if you are phase-on, which seems to be the case for at least the events that we have seen until now, you are mainly seeing, in fact, the 2-2 mode. It's if you see the source, on the other hand, a John, you are going to be also seeing the higher harmonics. So this is the fundamental harmonic. Then you can have the higher harmonic are suppressed, but they start to become important if you go in direction in which, because of the geometry, they count more than the 2-2 mode. And so there have been papers in the literature in the last year and year and a half with phenomenological models and also with the UBNR models. So the first next harmonics that are important are the 2-1, the 3-3, the 4-4, the 5-5. And this is what you see in these plots. And this is the overall signal. So if you have only the dominant harmonic is in blue, and the dominant plus the higher harmonics is in red. Now, I mean, what you can see here is that, I mean, in this particular case, there is not a huge effect. But as I said, it all depends also where you are seeing the signal, you know. And anyway, these differences are important at some point if you are really, you know, want to extract very important information. So why also higher harmonics are important? So now I want to show you especially the case in when you go to high masses. So this plot here shows the signal-to-noise ratio. It shows the distance in gigaparsec for an SRR of 12, and here you have the redshift as a function of the observed mass. So be careful, this is the observed mass. So if you go with a redshift of 1/400, total mass would correspond to 100 systems. Okay? So this... Well, this is the total mass.
Yeah, and redshift 400.
So if you have a redshift 1, the single component mass will be 100. Okay, so this will be 100. For equal mass, adding the higher harmonics, I mean, it's not a big difference because for equal mass, the higher harmonics are not so important. But when you start actually going to mass ratio 2, you can start seeing the difference in the distance at which you will go, mass ratio 3, mass ratio 4, okay, here. And now I want to stick with this, for example, 400 at the distance of 6-7 gigaparsec and mass ratio, redshift around 1. So how the signal will look like? Well, let's look at this plot here. You are going to see only the last part of the signal. This is for advanced LIGO design sensitivity, and what you see here actually in blue is the waveform, in red is the whitened waveform that you obtain by going to the Fourier domain divided by the signal to noise ratio, going back to the time domain, and these vertical lines tells you where you accumulate the majority of the signal to noise ratio, 10%, 20%, 30%, you accumulate in the last part. So, okay, this was mass ratio 1, and this is mass ratio 4, where the higher harmonics are important. Now, just to give you an example of an inference study, for example, again, mass ratio, I mean, here even mass ratio 4, total mass observed 500. So keep in mind this could be a component mass around 120 or something like that. So let's focus on the distance, and for example, and this is actually the inclination. So if you were using only the tutu mode, this is the dashed line, and this is what you use if you have the higher harmonics. So the distance can be recovered, for example, much better. And this is true also for, you see the masses, for example, what you would get if you only use the tutu mode. And this is the mass ratio. So higher harmonics help for, see, yeah?
Right, they help, but the volume goes down.
The volume goes down?
You don't see them as far away.
No, actually, it's the contrary.
So
if you take...
the dashed is only 2-2.
The dashed is only 2-2.
So they get, I see, so they get, when you include the extra modes, it gets louder.
And this is more important for larger mass ratio. As I, let me emphasize, if you take mass ratio 1, the effect is not huge.
Right.
But if the mass ratio is not 1, then this is important.
Part of that benefit is just that the dominant mode doesn't get into the detected band, right? Whereas the 4-4 does, because it's twice as
fast. Because we're at high mass.
Yeah,
we're
high mass. So
for 30-30s.
Yeah, this is what you see also here. This is total mass 50.
Yeah.
Total mass 50 with mass ratio 4. And these are again 10%. 20%, 30% of the accumulation of the SNR. The last part is not so important. You are dominated by here, and here actually the effect is not crucial. I mean, you have some differences in the amplitude, but it's not, crucial effect. So.
Sorry, has anybody done that same study for 3G detectors? Because I can imagine, like, if you get an SNR 100 thing, like, even if it's outside of the band, you could detect, like, IMVHs or something.
Yeah, so,
yes,
so
in fact.
This is relevant for the seed black hole stuff, right?
Yeah.
And this is in the report.
It's in our report. It's in the 3G report. It's actually, yeah, it's quite interesting. You can start to measure these things. The other cool thing, if you can go back to that distance uncertainty plot, right? You get the same effect for these seed black holes at redshift of 10 or something. But if you can measure the distance much more accurately at those kind of redshifts, actually you get the mass a lot better. Just because of the fact that the thing you measure in the detector is the redshifted mass.
Yeah.
And so if you get the distance, it can actually cut the mass uncertainty by a factor of 50%.
Very
if
cool.
You get the distance a lot better.
Yeah, well, this is quite interesting.
And this is in the 3G white paper?
It's mentioned. We're trying to work out.
The long version of the report is coming out in the fall, okay?
Okay.
Where this will
be. And the standard would be if you don't include this, you get a distance bias.
Yes.
Well, you get the distance for. You get
posterior
certainty, right?
It's not bias.
And there probably is a bias.
Well, what you see here, it's.
It's got to be a bias, right? Your signal model is not matching the data. So.
I mean, this is actually. Okay, I didn't say. The red, of course, maybe you understood
right.
That already. The red is the injection. I mean, you do get a bias.
Yeah, it's not obvious over population, you get a bias. The reason you're estimating this larger is probably because this thing is quite close to edge on.
But it seems like the population overall is louder. That means it's a bias.
I've done PD plots by accident using one with HM and one without, and it's terrible. It's very easy to tell.
Equation.
Yeah, so I was just wondering, do you have equivalent plots that only use the 2-2 modes but scale up the SNR so that it matches the SNR you get when you include all the modes?
No.
Okay, because my question would be, and in the posterior, just because the SNR is louder, or is it because...
No, you get more information about
you measured another harmonic, and so you can actually constrain
the inclination
angle a lot better.
Yeah, and in fact, we are looking into this because now there is, in fact, there are models, I emphasize this because that is the one I've been involved, but if you look into the literature, again, there are papers. So this is a model which is actually, So as the next strongest higher harmonics, the 3-3 to 1-4-4-5-5, and what you see here is just an example, the model used numerical relativity to be built with, and this is the unfaithfulness, so this is the line of 3%, and the model is, you know, a little bit above for high masses, 1%, but if we were not using the higher harmonics, will be this the agreement with an R, which NR include the higher harmonics. And this is a line spin. I will show you in a moment with precession, but this is a line spin. Okay, and I want to also emphasize that there have been papers understanding whether this inclusion of the higher harmonics is important for the searches. So there is a paper by Capano and also Ian here in the audience, even more recently. Because the question is, we are not using higher harmonics in the search, and there are part of the parameter space, maybe these larger mass ratios, and where you have also larger total mass, that could be interesting for sub-threshold searches. I don't know if you want to comment about, because I will not have a discussion about this, it will be... Do you have anything you want to say in one sentence about the importance of higher harmonics?
You can use semicolons.
higher harmonics seem cool. Let's search for them.
Okay, Ian is working on that.
No, not as hard as precession.
Okay, I have some more details about why the harmonics are important, but I'm going to skip this. I wanted to say that there is one paper out which has looked at gravitational wave 170729, because this was, as I told you at the beginning, was the heaviest binary black hole we had, which also was going, was the posterior were encompassing also mass ratios, which were not just one. And so a study was done, led by Caterina, in which waveform models now with higher modes. So in the previous plots, I was showing IMR phenom, SUBNR, but now there is also HM to say that these models have higher harmonics. And what you see here is the posterior distribution for the mass ratio, chi effective. And without the higher harmonics, you have these posteriors here that also encompass one in a more significant way, with respect to the case in which you use the higher harmonics, and there is also an effect on the chi effective. So the conclusion of this paper was that the measurement excluded equal mass at 90%. It's also true that, as emphasized in one part of the paper, there was an analysis also done with the other parameter estimation code that we have here, led by Rachel, and the results were not completely agreeing with this, but that is more trying to understand also why the two codes are giving slightly different results. But anyway, it's nice to see that this is now available. It's not, of course, all the modes, but we can start doing study for cases in which higher harmonics can play a role. Yes?
Is there any thoughts about redoing a lot of the analyses with these, like some of the other models?
Yes, I know that, yes, there are people in the collaboration, will not be, I think, it's not a LIGO paper, but there are some people who are actually redoing the analysis for all the events with these higher harmonics. We don't expect, for what we have discussed before, because of the Faison, you know, Faison, that we are going to see. This was, if you want, the case in which we would expect the largest effect.
Yeah.
And it's not dramatic.
Alexander, it's probably worth saying, because you keep saying we know these things are face-off. I think I would say we have no evidence that they're not face-off.
Okay.
Right? They could be anything, but equal mass, we wouldn't be able to count. Or edge-on and not precession. Because we're basically seeing one polarization of gravitational. Right? And so we're really not measuring the inclination. So some of these actually, the support for
generally there is also
goes all the way to 90 degrees.
Yeah, you are right. Plus. You are right.
Right? So if you do this for the other events, what you're likely to do is actually just chop the edge of the posteriors. So there is currently some support, even in the things that basically look equal mass, for the thing being maybe edge on and having a relatively high mass ratio. that part of the parameter space would be excluded if you included higher modes. But the peak probably wouldn't really change. You might just kind of kill the tail in a couple of directions.
Mostly doesn't even do that. Mostly it's all the same.
Yeah. So to check, in terms of the polarization, is this essentially because Hanford and Livingston are flipped so that you need something comparable sensitivity or a very strong event with a differently oriented detector in order to get decent polarization?
So even if you took Virgo at design sensitivity and the two LIGOs at design sensitivity and just went over the sky, you said, on average, what's our sensitivity? You know, you can always then pick the best polarization, and what's our sensitivity to the other polarization? It's typically 10%. Even with Virgo at design, it's only by the time you add Cargo or LIGO in, you're like, it's up to 0.3 or 0.5. And then, even then, so then you can bound the 45-50 degrees. And that's some of these other effects.
Okay, so now let me tell something that is also coming out soon. So, of course, now we can put together precession and higher harmonics. And so I want to show you these results, which, as I said, will come out soon. And I know also that the Phenom people are also working on something similar. We are working parallel. So this is a model that, so these are the results of the overlap between actually the big catalog that from the SXX that just came out a few months ago. In particular, here we used 1,344 precessing waveforms, plus also some precessing waveforms which we produce at AI which are not yet public, 141. And the new model, okay, for people who know, this is just jargon, it's called V4PHN. And here it's compared. This is just a numerical relativity, only the 2-2 mode, the old model, which is V3, which has been used in the catalog to show you the results, to produce the result that I showed you at the beginning of the talk, the precessing model. And this is the new model here. But this is against when you use the 2-2 mode in numerical relativity. And you see there is an interesting improvement. You had outliers up to, 14%. And this is average. It's at fixed inclination, average over the other angle parameters. And then actually you take masses between 20 and 200 solar masses, and you take the worst case, the worst unfaithfulness. So there is certainly an improvement, and this is without actually when you in going from this model to the old one, from the old model to the new one, there is no calibration for numerical relativity. Was just adding improving actually the. Say in another way. There was improvement of numerical relativity for the two-body dynamics in the aligned case, but not for the precession part. And now, when you actually add, take numerical relativity with the modes up to 5, and you compare with 2, you can see that there is also a very interesting improvement. So if you were not adding the higher harmonics, you again would have larger effect, and here you see that the posterior peaks, in particular, in this region here, but extends for some cases up to 0.6 or 0.06, 0.07.
The histogram kind of buries a lot of interesting information. So let me try and do you have a plot that does this like M and Q, and then maybe colored by the match?
Not for this talk.
So
I can show you maybe.
Yeah, no, because that would be really easy. So just to understand what you're doing, you're taking one of the SXX catalog, you're picking a bunch of different, scaling to a bunch of different masses for a given mass rate that you're picking, and then you're doing...
This is faithfulness. I'm not changing the parameters.
Oh, okay, great.
I didn't explain well. So what I'm saying is that you fix 20 solar masses, and all the parameters of the NR, you don't change anything in the model, but then you change the total mass. You go to 80, up to 200 solar masses. And the worst unfaithfulness is in this plot.
Of that mass, I get it. Okay.
Okay? Now,
have you fed the waveforms to the catalog?
So what was done here is that we took the aligned spin model, which is before, which is used in for the second O2 was used and also now, aligned spin that was tuned to NR for the dynamics and the merger, etc. Now you take this model, and you had first of all the higher harmonics, okay, that was also tuned aligned case, but then now you rotate, you use this rotation to generate the precessing model, and then you don't use anything on numerical relativity. You just then take and compare with the precessing numerical relativity. So this can be further improved by now adding more features, that information on precession from NR. But otherwise, that's the model, which is already quite, I think, nice, because it can be used. Now, I want to show you one thing also related to what Star was saying more at the beginning of the talk. So there is this plot that I took from one of the surrogate papers, the NR surrogates. In particular, this was from the VARM I told. And what you see here, this is with the old SUBNR, not the one that I just showed you in the previous plot. And this was the comparison between the surrogate, which was built for mass ratio less than 4, spins up to 0.8, and about 20 orbits. And what you can see here is the Poisson distribution, which if you, of course, not put all the higher harmonics in NR, as you know, a better agreement if you go in this direction, but this doesn't change much. And this in agreement with what I was showing you, I think here, that in fact, if you don't put the higher harmonics, you can improve here, but also the fact that you see now with the new model, you can take away all more of this tail here, which is what you see going up to 10% that you see in this plot here. Normally, we are happy when the unfaithfulness is below 1% or 3%, let's say. Although that's not, historically, there is this 3%. But, okay, so I wanted also to say that there have been also work on the IMR phenom. They have improved their model, making the two spins now independent, while before this, the precession was actually captured by one effective spin. And in this paper, you can see a comparison also with all the SUBNR model. Anyway, I don't want to go into this here because I want to discuss other important things. Neutron star black holes. That's another part of the waveform models where I should say we are not in a very good shape at the moment. Some of you are looking forward to the next neutron star black, to the first neutron star black hole. I should say that some people are not really looking forward, because I'm sure that at that point people are going to ask, what's the waveform we are going to use? How we extend the tidal parameters? Is that precise or not accurate? So some of us would like to wait a little bit. So what's the status, in fact? So there has been work that has been done to produce waveform with tidal effects for neutron star black holes. But these waveform models are not sufficiently accurate. And this was shown in particular in this paper by Chakravarti a year and a half ago. Now, I want just to give you what are the main ingredients that enter in these models that one has to take into account, and what we are doing in a few slides. At AI. So, first of all, there was this quite interesting paper by Panarale and collaborators, where they point out, they built actually the first model for neutron star black holes. And the model was built in the following way. So, if you just focus on the amplitude, as we discussed actually in the last few days, maybe more last week with Brian talk, what you expect is that depending on the neutron star being disrupted by the black hole or not, and that depends on the mass ratio and the mass of the neutron star or the compactness, you end up having either a signal which is very close to a black hole with a ring down, if it is not disrupted. The only difference is that you have to take into account during the spiral the tidal effects that are not there for the black hole, black hole. But that, from the point of view of the amplitude, is just really the normal binary black hole amplitude with the ring down. But the ring down, you have to compute with some differences from the ring down of a black hole, because you have the neutron star and it's not the same mapping. But if the neutron star is disrupted, and this happens for certain value of the mass ratio and again the value of the neutron star, so if it basically starts plunging and being already disrupted, then the signal, the amplitude is different. You have almost a shutdown of the amplitude. You don't have the ring down, basically. The amplitude just goes down. And so what Banarale did was that he took results from the literature, from neutron star black hole simulation, at the time mainly from Shibata's group, and he built a formula that tells you when the mass ratio is smaller than a certain value, that depends on the compactness and the spin of the black hole, then you are in the disrupted regime, and there you have to do this correction of the amplitude. So why we care about correcting the amplitude? We care because depending on the mass of the black hole, these differences in the amplitude can happen at few hundred hertz, several hundred hertz. I mean, depends on the mass of the black hole, and that could have an effect on your parameter estimation. If you are asking now to extract the tidal deformability parameter, it may depend where you cut the signal, whether it's a ring down, where it's, you know, this is what you... And so what we are doing is that we are doing something quite simple. We are basically taking a neutron star, a black hole in spiral waveform for the frequency domain part, the phase, which has tidal effects. And then we are adding, in the way in which Panarale did that, but trying to improve, because now there are waveforms from the SXS collaboration from François Foucault, try to include this cutoff. And this is an example in which this was a mass ratio 2, non-spinning, the black hole, where you see here the amplitude, actually very flat as a function of frequency. This is the phase difference with this model. This is quite preliminary, and the phase difference is better to see this plot. So this is the SXS NR waveform for neutron star black hole, mass ratio 2. And here you see the agreement. At the very end, at the very end here. And for the disruptive case, this was mass ratio 6, where you have to recover the ring down, I mean, like a binary black hole. There is quite a good agreement where you have the two waveforms that overlap. The last part agrees less well, because there you also need to correct for the quasi-normal mode frequency and decay time, because here what you use are the ones that come from the two black holes, but if you have a neutron star black hole, the formula is different, and this has not been done yet. So, and I know also that other people are doing work similar, yes?
How big are the errors in the NR models? What's the convergence testing on the...
Well, these are more the François Foucault, who has some estimation of the error, so the error is smaller than what you see here. But, you know, I mean, I'm actually not so worried about this last part, that this we are not going to see. I think it's more important here to get right the tidal deformability effect in the last part here, and where the cutoff, this change of amplitude, have to happen. If we can get that, then it's already a good model, starting model for, you know, if we have a detection of a neutron star black hole to use. I mean, this is more for the future. Yes?
I just wanted a little bit of an explanation on what is different in the background. Is it just the background of the ring down? Is it just an uncertainty on what is the final mass of the black hole for them to get
exactly? So in binary black hole, for the binary black holes, we estimate the final mass and the final spin from these fits on numerical relativity waveform. So you have to change them for a neutron star and a black hole, not two black holes. And this has been done recently in the literature. There is a paper by Zappa and the group in Vienna, so it can be used, but was not used yet in these plots. Maybe it's not even very accurate. I don't know how accurate it is. Okay, but now I have 10 minutes, and I actually want to more discuss the systematics. So, I mean, this plots were just saying, I go back to the systematics now, after telling you which other physics we are trying to introduce. There were studies of the systematics for the binary black holes, but I care more to show you these plots. Because I think, I mean, for what we have observed until now, I think we are fine. I mean, you also have a paper with Williamson about this, but you agree with me that we should be okay.
For short term, yeah.
Okay. But what about the near future? So I want to show two cases for the binary black hole and the binary neutron star. So if you consider the source we have detected, but suppose that you are at design sensitivity for advanced LIGO. Well, this source would have had a signal-to-noise ratio around 70. So now suppose that what you do here, you inject a numerical relativity waveform, which we have with the parameter of gravitational wave 15 to 914, and you recover with IMR phenom. This is IMR phenom 22. And this is a busy plot. By the way, this is a study that is in preparation by Michael Purer and Karl Haster. And what you show, what is shown here is the recovery of the Chir mass. And so, yeah, this is the Chir mass. And okay, this blue line is, I mean, look at the scale, okay? So this is what you O1 did. I mean, if you use O1, I mean, you recover very well the Chir mass, okay? This is the injected value. But if you go to this combination after the Livingstone Virgo Kagra design sensitivity, you get the red, the orange, okay? Displaced from the injected value. And this is for the Chir mass, you can see this is the injected value, and in dashed, it's a little bit outside. And of course, if you go to next, future detector, Voyager, ETC, it's even worse. But let's focus on design sensitivity. And now let's look at the chi effective and distance inclination. So this is again the injected value. And of course, O1 encompasses it, the green. But if you take advanced sensitivity, it's displaced. And this is true also for, you know, these results of the inclination angle and the distance, as you can see here. They also did a study with, they used a population.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Why is it displaced towards chi p 1?
That I don't. You mean why not in another direction?
Yeah.
I mean, a good point. I don't know.
Latching on to other features in the signal that by Mark Fennell he doesn't have, and trying to fit it by making something extreme. You see that in other cases. I can show you whether it's.
Okay, so sorry. They also did a study where they actually injected. So here they used actually the NR surrogate, the first one, which had mass ratio between 1 and 2 only. So this is just mass ratio 1 and 2. So they injected this precise NR waveform, they recovered with IMR phenom, and again advanced sensitivity. If you focus on the orange, this, you look at the Chir mass and the mass ratio plot, and you can see here the bias. They just wanted to have an idea of the bias in the parameters that you can get. And chi effective is here. So of course this is one study, but these are waveforms that we are currently using. I show you that there is already an improvement of this waveform coming on, but you know, this means that there is work to be done. So let's switch to binary neutron star. So if you remember, these are the posterior distribution from the paper with a prior 0.05 for the spin, and many models here. The posterior distribution in blue is the IMR phenom P that you see. And then there are other models here. And, you know, when the prior is 0.05, my conclusion was, okay, all the models are very close to each other. I mean, their posterior are a little bit different within the 90%, but we should not pay attention, I believe, in what happens within the 90%. But Taylor, which is the post-Newtonian model, was here, a little bit farther away. It's always the model that is a bit farther away. If the spin are larger, the prior is 0.89, the models have some differences. But overall, I would say we are still dominated by the statistical error. Now, let's do the same study. I mean, this was done out by Samajdar and Dietrich. Similar to the one I showed you before for the binary black hole, let's take this, and now let's go to advanced LIGO design sensitivity. So the source is at 50 megaparsec. Now, here, they didn't inject an NR waveform. They do this study, they injected an IMR phenom waveform with tidal effects. And here, they are interested in comparing models which have the same tidal effects, but different baseline for the non-tidal effect, the binary black hole baseline. Because remember that we use a binary black hole waveform and we add tidal effects on top of it. So now you are asking, let's use waveform that have exactly the same tidal effects, but they have slightly different you know, point particle information, the binary black hole information, the black hole information. Doesn't matter. And for an equal mass, this is the recovery of the lambda tilde parameter. There is no much, I mean, there is some variation. This is the injected value in black. These are model, the Taylor model, the SUBNR, etc. The model injected was non-spinning. I found a bit strange, I should say, that they injected a non-spinning model, which is this one, and the model with spin align, which is also, of course, non-spinning. I mean, that is spinning. It can recover the injection better than the model that was injected. which is because one is spinning, one is precessing, and the other not. For some reason, if you inject something non-spinning, the model which has no precession can capture it. Well, I don't know why. But they point out the most important thing is that, for example, the UBNR model is here, which is displaced from, you know, the injection value. However, this only affects the tidal deformability parameter. The other parameters are not affected. Mass ratio, total mass, chi effective, they are very close to each other. So they are saying for the tidal deformability...
Is it always in one direction?
Well, unfortunately, they did two injections. So they only did equal mass and equal mass. The two is not a very extensive study. I think this study should be done in a more comprehensive way. I also don't understand, I mean, I show you in for the binary black hole gravitational wave 150914 like event, I mean, when you go to an SNR of 70, the binary black hole already, the model for the binary black hole doesn't perform very well. I mean, you saw it from the, so I'm not completely surprised that also that start to be inaccurate for a binary neutron star where the SNR is 87. Okay?
Actually, sort of a question about that. Is this including the type of squeezing that's going to especially improve the high frequency sensitivity?
No, no, this is not even that. No, this is just advanced LIGO, this official, is no longer even the zero detune, I don't remember. It's the official advanced LIGO design sensitivity curve. There is not A plus. It's not A plus.
But I think that curve now does, like the most recent equipment scenario, the design curve does include frequency dependent squeezing.
Ah, also already included a little bit of improvement high frequency.
Yeah,
okay.
It's because they have, I mean, we have it in the detectors now, so like it's part of the official LIGO design scope.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so I have just.
What also, let me just add that SNR for BNS. I mean, we'll need something like 1,000.
No, the SNR is 87.
Yeah.
So we'll need 1,000 BNS in the same
form. Yeah, we needed 25 before we saw the one we saw.
Right.
You know, it's something that happened next year.
No, are you saying that, for example, the one that we saw? The probability to see it in advanced LIGO is what?
Because 1 in 30. Right. For this, it's 1 in 1,000.
Why?
No, but Dan, she's also saying more sensitive detector.
Yeah, you could
still.
I mean, as long as the universe doesn't end.
It's one in a thousand. Yeah, but with the new detector, you'll get a lot more.
But we need to get on the order of a thousand.
So, in fact,
that's going to happen soon, right?
Daniel, I think this would be very interesting. I think it would be.
Cole's not getting any younger, so pick up the pace.
I think it would be very interesting to try to do a study which is more comprehensive than this, but with maybe more realistic distribution of the SNR of this. Because this is scary. I mean, it's. But is that really realistic, you know, that we are going, you are saying not, but, basically.
I think it is scary because we've got, you know, if third generation detectors happen on a 15-year timescale based on, and this is a much more complicated problem than the lightning black hole problem, right? You need to get all the, to actually get...
No, but I'm talking about advanced LIGO. I'm not talking about 3G or, I'm talking just advanced LIGO. In the next 5-6 years, do we have to care about this?
There's a good, not trivial chance we will. We definitely have to for 3G. It's probably going to be a problem that takes, if you
also,
solve, it's going to take 10 years to solve.
Okay. Also notice that this is mass ratio 1.5. I mean, for binary neutral star, it's not clear if that will be also realistic.
I'm just more depressed that that's the best we're going to do with an SNR 90 event.
Are you worried about the systematics in your...
So if you took 17817 and you put it at design sensitivity, then you can actually tell that it's neutral stars from the gravitational waves, which you can't with 17817. So that's a good result to have, right? But you don't get precision radius measurements with a second generation gravitational wave detector. Cosmic Explorer.
E.T.
Okay, so I have just a, can I have a just few minutes to finish? I just wanted to make another important point because, you know, I think I think we discussed eccentricity, important, I mean, to have these models with harmonics and spin, precession, neutral sub-black holes modeling. But I wanted to say that where the effort also, I think, should be for the simulations, neutral sub-black holes, is in the region where we have the most disagreement between the models that we have today. And if we just focus on the aligned spin models for which these studies have been done, the V4 and IMR phenom, and you compute the faithfulness, which is again the overlap without changing the parameters, the region where you have majority of the difference, you know, that larger than 0.97, in this region where the mass ratio is larger than 4 and spin are larger than 0.8, and where when I show you where we do the calibration with NR, we don't have waveform from NR. Okay, and so let me show you again this in a better way, this plot here. So again, binary effective spin, symmetric mass ratio. This region here, I mean, it's all compressed, but this point has spin 0.85, mass ratio 8. And this simulation that was done by the BAM group, by Haman and Mark and Sasha, was the one going in the most extreme region, but only 15 gravitational wave cycles. If you have a waveform which is very short, it cannot fix the calibration. When you do the calibration against the analytical model, it's not really fixing, you know, the model when you then go to much longer waveforms, which is what you need in band. And this is the region where numerical relativity has the is more challenging for numerical relativity. There have been some study, I was part of this, where you try to use different NR codes, you use the best of the codes, you put together the spectral code by SXX and the one of finite difference, like the Einstein toolkit, you do simulations with SXX up to a certain frequency or separation, and then you use the other one because the SXX has more problems in going through merger for this larger mass ratio and spins. And so there you can use the finite difference code that seems to be more robust in that regions. But this is just a temporary fix, cannot be done, you know, in the next like this for the next 10 years. So people are working on better codes. You can use the surrogate, but again, the surrogate, even the surrogate, I mean, is not going to solve this problem because you have to do numerical simulation in that region in order to use them. So I think this is another area where we need improvement, and this comes from the numerical relativity people. Now, I skip this. I go just to the last thing I want to summarize. So, okay, let me know this nice work. Let's see if you agree. We have not missed loud events. Loud emit above our threshold, I think. Do we all agree, or?
We can't say what's in O3, but yeah.
No, not O3. I mean, I'm talking about O1 and O2. For sub-threshold events, especially after the nice discussion yesterday and a nice talk by Ian, maybe, you know, it might be critical if you want to really pull out more interesting events, sub-threshold, to include more physics, precession, eccentricity, no? Because they are, because you might, they might...
I would say not until we know that there is a population of these types of signals. If we know there's a population of eccentric systems, then we'll probably be able to dig out more of them in this way. But while that's not the case, you're probably not doing that. It might be the case, though, that you're, if these things are dropping, like you're only picking up 60% or something of the signal to noise ratio for like the eccentric 0.5 system, which you're going to miss completely, then, I mean, these aren't sub-threshold events at all at this point. They're loud events that you're missing.
Well, I didn't show actually these plots that were from a study with actually, they're led by Ian, but I mean, so even, you know, even the fact that, you know, you could ask the question, okay, we have not, we are not using a template bank which has precession. Are we missing events with precession? And I think, you know, this was an injection study done in which you inject precessing signals and, you know, gravitational wave 15.0914 here, and where you start having an effect on the fitting factor is only in this region here where the mass ratio, you know, is larger. I mean, it's V5, and the masses are, total mass is small here.
Just so I understand, is that equivalent to a 5% change in SNR?
Yes, I would say.
Yeah, if you cube that number, it's the number of systems you're going to miss.
Right,
if you assume that you have a constant SNR threshold for detection,
right.
Which is not true, but
right,
it's cube that number and it's the number of systems you miss.
So,
yeah.
Okay.
And the bank is 97 anyway, right? So it's not huge.
What's the assumption I'm speaking for that?
This should be okay. I mean, this means that...
I think it's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we can be a little better, but it's okay for now. I mean,
you're using the paper ladder.
There are two dimensions missing on that part.
Now, the problem is the thing that gets suppressed in this plot is the ones you're actually really missing and are really interesting.
If you read the paper, that question is answered, and that question is answered as well.
Okay, so I mean, this is more for the discussion later. I don't want to take a lot of your time. So I think also we can say that inference from gravitational observation is dominated at the moment by statistical instead of modeling error. I think maybe now, I'm sure you are perhaps convinced about that. Highest priorities. This is more in my list, maybe agrees with your list. I think use black hole modeling is very important. Inclusion of eccentricity and spins in IMR waveform. Also very important, and what I was emphasizing at the end. But putting together this talk, I also realized that there is really, I mean, so difficult to, there are studies, you know, you have one paper did two injections to look at the system, another paper they did, but they use only this waveform, which maybe is old. And so what is also needed to understand, especially the biases, because the fact that you get an overlap which is, you know, not very high doesn't tell you which parameters are affected and whether you should care about that or not. So this is also needed. And we don't have at the moment a very extensive comprehensive studies about that. Okay, so I finish here. If you have questions or maybe later you can, although today is the almost the last day. Yes.
Yeah, I guess I just have a question about, I guess, the third point and the last point. So it seems that even if for individual events, the errors are big enough to include the true parameters. If there's a systematic shift, even if it's extremely small in the individual events, especially if it always goes one way in like the distance or the masses or something, it'll first impact when the population analysis, and that would already happen with 10.
Yeah, for example, this study should be done to understand this.
So has anyone done a study?
No.
So don't we care about, like, is our N-MAP screwed up somehow?
That's what Dan is, we're trying to do that. That's why we, for those of you who are on the rates of population, when you constantly hear us talk about Hooting's lens with specific approximates, that's what we're gearing up to do. But it's not, we have to run with all the approximates. And there is one code which is running with all of them, and that will be mine. So you just have to do it. It takes time.
Are there systematics that you already noticed, like the spin magnitudes are always?
Recessing cases are really weird, but you probably know that. I also have an example of IMRF-NLP doing it weird. And I can't run with all the approximates. I can't run with IMRF-NLP, so it's not the most systematic comparison of systematics. So yeah, spin orientations and magnitudes are weird.
But I mean, it's true that even without thinking about 3G and LISA, I mean, there is still many things here for the next 4, 5, 6 years.
It's scary.
Okay, there was another question. You have a question.
Yeah, so when you were talking about the difficulties in hybridizing really short waveforms, what was the outcome of, I know you and I think Vivian were working on marginalizing over fitting parameters as a way to...
Yes, I didn't discuss this. Yeah. This is something that actually Stephen Green is doing at AI. So, what he's saying is the following. So when we calibrate the model in, you know, against numerical relativity simulation, we have some parameters that describe higher order post-Newtonian terms that are not known, and we fit this parameter with the numerical relativity simulation. But the value that we get, depends on, so we notice that if the simulation is very short, you can do this test, you can fit these parameters to a certain length of the simulation, then you change the length and you find new values. Then you compare the waveforms for each of these values, so you have now a model with value A, value B, value C. They should be very close to each other. If you see that they are not, that their overlap is larger than 1% or 3%. This means the calibration has not been very good in fixing the calibration parameter. You didn't converge, basically. And so what is interesting to do is to try to put an error bar on the waveform model that we built, based on the fact that we have not fixed these parameters. And then you marginalize, when you do your Bayesian analysis, you can marginalize, I mean, you can take, you can put a thickness on your result in this way. I mean, you can take into account the fact that the waveform actually has an error, and you take that into account. I mean, I think that is better than combining posteriors of models. So this work is going on, it's not yet finished, and I think that is very important. But it's still, how do you put that error in a region where you don't have an R? Because that you can put based on, how large is the region of the parameters that you are fitting, that give you a good waveform, but still with some error. But in region in which you don't have the NR waveform, then I don't know how you would extrapolate this.
Well, I mean, you could take the extreme case of having infinite uncertainty in those calibration parameters, right? Where you, of a toy model, is you have some parameter that decides how you match up a, let's say, a post-Newtonian waveform to some ring down description.
and you have infinite uncertainty on how to match those two up. So you effectively just throw away any phase coherence you would have crossing that border, but you can kind of effectively do independent PE on the beginning and the end of the waveform, right? So it seems to me like you could take that extreme case where you just kind of lose phase coherence or something in the middle.
Okay. Yeah, it will be interesting to discuss, but so this is going on, and I think it will be an interesting waveform model to be used to test, you know, against, I mean, to use for the parameter estimation. Okay, any other question? Yeah.
I was very interested, actually. The visual kicks, what can you say about them for the, all these type of LIGO sources?
You mean for kicks of the...
Experiments, yeah.
Okay, I should say there is a paper actually Davide Gerosa wrote some years ago in which he was even computing, because when you compute these waveforms in the ring down, you don't take into account the fact that the object that is formed that can have a speed, and so this creates a blue shift or red shift on the waveform, on the quasi-normal mode, you know, frequencies. And he showed in this paper that perhaps if you go at in LISA, when you have to be very lucky, maybe, you know, you might see this effect. You have to, I mean, if you include it in the waveform, you will be able to measure the kick in that way. Otherwise, I mean, forgetting about a direct measurement of the kick from the shift in the quasi-normal mode frequencies, I mean, once you know the parameters, you can compute the kick. Because there are, you know, from numerical relativity and analytical work, you have formula. So it's not going to add, I think it's an observable that you can extract. Once you know the parameter, the spin and the masses, you can say also what was the kick value.
But I guess you'd have to know a lot about the spins and their orientation.
You cannot do it today because you don't have much, like the kick, for example, unless you are looking at non-zero case, it's very important if the spins are on the orbital plane or not, and we are not sensitive. At the moment, we are not able to say anything. We don't have evidence for precession, so we are not. The simulation I show you, that animation that was giving you the black hole spin very well, that would be great to determine the key, because that spin was almost on the orbital plane.
So can you say anything about the key distribution right now?
I think, I don't think so. I mean, you could take, you know, the posterior distribution from the data of LIGO and use them, and use the formula that are in the literature, compute the kick distribution.
Yeah, but it's,
I don't think...
It would be the same as just taking whatever
distribution. Like, it would not be informative. It should not be informative, because it's very sensitive to the spins.
Yeah.
So that's issues. It's probably not super kicks.
But if you have low spin, then it's quite dependent on the mass ratio. So if you're at equal mass and no spin, there's no kick at all.
You have no local effect.
We don't constrain the spins in the plane very well. If you look at that flop that Alexander showed, and it's the spins in the plane that lead to the kick, right?
You probably exclude the super kick though, because that requires 45 degrees, and we've seen that. That was extreme.
Yeah, but it's 5,000 against 4,000, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's not that. It's 1,000. If they're all lying in the place, you can get about 1 or 2,000. Yeah. It doesn't matter if they're all not spinning anyway.
Yeah, I guess if they're all in a couple hundred.
A couple hundred requires a pretty significant mass ratio.
So you remember this plot where, you know, we don't really, it's agreed with the posterior, the measurement of the spin on the orbital plane. We don't really can say much about it. Okay.
Great.
Okay, bye.
So I think we're done.
We're done.
The program.
Oh. Thank you to the organizers.